2. The tall man pounded on the black stone wall. The wall stretched up as far as the eye could see, at least in these dimly lit reaches of the ruined undercity, and was angled back, not truly vertical. The stone from which it was made was glossy, with little gray stipple patterns throughout, lending it beauty and complexity. The wall did not seem to be made of blocks of the stone. The entire wall seemed to be one sheet, unmarked by lines or creases. The stone held up against blows from his fist. He found a block of ferrocrete nearby, and swung it with all his considerable strength at the wall. The ferrocrete shattered. He ignited his weapon. It hummed with every move of his arm, and cast its red glow on the stone. He drove it into the stone. The stone did not warm, did not burn, did not melt away. He withdrew his blade and touched the point where it had rested. It was warmer than the surrounding stone, but did not burn his flesh. He shouted, the echoes of his anguish bouncing off the high ceiling and nearby walls of this chamber. He had to have what was beyond the wall. It was everything. He had never seen it, never felt it. But he knew it was there, knew with a memory that had been vivid long before he had become aware. The tall man felt something, a presence nearby. He raced to a mound of rubble, collapsed from ruined ceiling, and swept a block of diracrete aside. In the niche beyond huddled a small figure, a human male. The tall man reached in and seized the other, yanking him forth. The smaller man wore rags and stank of sweat, months of sweat. His hair was long and ragged, and fear filled his dark eyes. The tall man did not speak to him. He did not know words. Instead, he made a thought, an image of the black wall shattering, opening to reveal the treasure beyond, and shoved it into the mind of the other. The smaller man stiffened and shrieked, as the thought lodged in his mind occupied it fully. Then the tall man sent another thought, a question, how? The smaller man trembled in his grip, and thoughts, hundreds of them, tiny and scurrying like rodents, flashed through his mind. Then there was an image, a machine, something a man could hold in two hands. From its nozzle came a blinding blaze, a cutting fire. The small man thought of that fire piercing the wall, cutting a door, allowing the tall man through. The tall man formed another thought. In it, the small man would go forth, find that machine, and bring it here, immediately. With ruthless strength, he hammered that thought into the small man's mind, heard his new shriek. Then he dropped the small man. His new slave, weeping, sobbing, ran off into the darkness. Borlias. Colonel Tycho Selchu, Wedge Antilles' second-in-command, entered the general's office. He was grinning and could not seem to stop, unusual for the reserved officer, who seldom betrayed emotions for more than a moment in any official situation. "General," he said, "I present you with the officer in charge of the Tanab Yellow Aces." He gestured like a master of ceremonies toward the door, which he left open behind him. Into the office stepped a broad-shouldered man, handsome and dark-haired, the sort on whom middle age settled like a set of rakish clothes. He wore a jumpsuit of poisonous yellow, accentuated by jagged lines of black, like a mad decorator's interpretation of a brainwave, and instead of saluting, struck a heroic pose. "Captain Wes Jansen reporting, sir." Wedge rose to clasp Jansen's hand, then dragged the man to him in an embrace. "Wes! They didn't tell me you were part of the incoming group." "I laid down some bribes. Couldn't have them spoil my big moment. Say, what's to drink?" "Home-brewed poison, for the most part, except on rare occasions. Here, sit." Wedge took his own seat, and once Tycho had shut the door for privacy, the other two followed suit. Jansen pulled a data card out of one of his jumpsuit's many pockets and flipped it onto Wedge's desk. I'm sure you've gotten the inventory from Reckless Abandon already, but here's my copy, just to make sure they're the same. Foodstuffs, ammunition, munitions, spare starfighter parts, several barrels of inadequately aged Tonab fruit brandies. Wonderful. Wedge slipped the card into his datapad, reviewing the words that scrolled up on his screen. How long will you be in system? Oh, until I get killed, I guess. Startled, Wedge glanced up at him. How's that again? The Tonab Yellow Aces is an all-volunteer unit, financed by the same fundraising effort that went into purchasing and delivering all those inventory goods organized by me. When I resigned my commission, I told my superiors I'd be back with a piece of Tsavong La in my pocket. I can't disappoint them. Wedge smiled. Care to transfer into Rogue Squadron? I'd love to, but I can't. I brought a squad and a half of Tonab and refugee pilots who sort of have the right to follow my lead. Tycho made a tisk-tisk noise. How very responsible of you, Wes. Jansen shrugged, rueful. Sad side effects of age, I'm afraid. His expression became livelier. Which you can help me forget. Tell me about a female pilot, twin son's leader. She has a nice voice. Does she have looks to match? Wedge, struggling to keep from laughing, exchanged a glance with Tycho. Well, yes, she's nice-looking. Married? Attached? Attached, I think. Recently attached. To my nephew, Wedge added to himself, no matter how hard they try to keep others from noticing. So, who is she? Wedge frowned, as if remembering, Jay something. Isn't that right? He turned to Tycho. I think so. Jay. Wedge let his expression clear. That's it, Jaina Solo. Jansen's face paled. Jaina Solo? I'm sure that's the name. Sispawn, I was flirting with a 9-year-old. 19, Tycho corrected. And she has more kills than the three of us put together at the same age. Jansen sighed, defeated. I guess I'd better apologize to her and then throw myself on her lightsaber. Wedge shook his head. No, just ask Han to shoot you. It'll be more merciful, and it is his right as a father. You're still a nasty commanding officer, you know. Wedge merely smiled. Domain Hull, World Ship, Piria System. The Yuuzhan Vong warrior, Chul Kong La, was old, far older than any who had been seen by the natives of this galaxy. Under the scars, tattoos, and mutilations that rendered his face almost black and his features almost unrecognizable were deep wrinkles of age. The frailty of his form was concealed by the augmented Von Doon crab armor he wore, armor that added the strength of its own muscles to his. He stood in his preferred control chamber of the Domain Hull World Ship. The walls were thick with the stations of his various advisors and subordinate officers, including his personal aide, the warrior Kozdok Bull. Most of the stations were a series of shelf-like recesses in the Yorick coral wall, and upon these recesses were villips, the preferred communications method of the Yuuzhan Vong. Some were in contracted form, featureless blobs, while some were everted to look like glossy, colorless Yuuzhan Vong heads, whose lips moved and voices emerged in perfect synchronization with distant officers and spies. Above Chul Kong La's seat was a great membranous lens, in diameter 3 times the length of a tall warrior. It gave him an unparalleled view of the space before Domain Hull, and could contract to magnify very distant objects. Before the old warrior was a priest. He was tall, his leanness suggesting self-deprivation, and he wore the ceremonial robes and head wrap of the order of the trickster goddess, Yun Harla. "Welcome, Harar," Chul Kong La said. "It is my honor to come before you again." The priest offered the sort of bow that equals exchange, then straightened. "And to find you engaged in work benefiting the gods and befitting your status. I bring you ships and ground reinforcements to help you in your aims. Indeed, the reinforcements had made a flyover to announce their presence to and respect for the old warrior, commander of Yuuzhan Vong forces in the Puria system. I am directed by my son to offer you every assistance in capturing Jaina Solo. The old warrior beckoned to a much younger male who waited near the wall. The younger warrior stepped forward and knelt. Arar, I bestow upon you Charak Kral. He has been in charge of special operations where Jaina Solo and other matters are concerned. He leads an inventive and well-motivated unit made up of Kral and Hull pilots and knowledge harvesters. My burdens of command will be lightened rather than increased if you simply take him off my hands and assume direct control of those operations. Harar addressed the younger warrior. Do you feel you can readily transfer your service? The question was a matter of life and death. Should Charak Kral, in honesty, say he could not, he would naturally be killed and a more agreeable commander installed. Charak Kral raised his head to look into Harar's face. The warrior's nose was not just deformed, a mutilation common to Yuuzhan Vong warriors, but entirely missing, with ragged reddened edges all around to suggest the violence with which it had been removed. His forehead was high, more like a human's than that of a Yuuzhan Vong, and elaborately tattooed with perpendicular lines and stripes that drew the eye back along it and made it seem flatter. My duty is to the gods, our leaders, and Domain Kral, he said. I will serve gladly. Good, Harar said. What are your most current operations? We have recently lost our human spy within their great abomination building. So I have engineered a plan to introduce one or more new spies into their camp. We will do this on the next occasion that an assault is made against their camp. Just like that? Harar asked. The infidels get no opportunity to refuse our gift of a spy? Charak Kral offered a warrior's smile, broken teeth visible to slitted lips. They do not, great priest. When my audience with Shulkong Law is done, you will come with me and tell me of your plan. Coruscant. As his group entered a long gallery that had once been flanked by stores and emporiums, Luke again felt a twinge, some distant wrongness in the force. The sensation had come to him before, and he had steered toward it, hoping that it was the source of the unease, the visions that had brought him to Coruscant on this mission. But his fellow Jedi had not always seemed to share his perceptions. He glanced at them. Mara was already looking his way, nodding. Tahiri stared off into the distance, in the direction of the twinge, alert as a hunting beast. Even Danny was gazing in that general direction, a hint of confusion evident, even through her Yuuzhan Vong makeup. Did any of you feel something? She asked. Yeah, Kel said. Hunger, time to break? Luke shook his head. Not in the open like this. Aw, explosive charges are so much more vivid when they go off in the open. Tahiri stared up at him, scornful. Do you only ever think about one thing? One thing at a time, sure. Now it's my stomach. Another feeling intruded on Luke's finely tuned senses, a whiff of danger, far more immediate than the previous sensation. He whispered, Trouble. In a moment the others moved to form a circle, Mara, Tahiri, Kel, and Face on the outside, the others within. No one brought out a technological weapon, but Luke felt to make sure that his lightsaber was still hanging at hand, and Face and Kel snapped their false amphistaffs out into rigidity. A great roar of voices sounded from ahead and above, out of two storefronts at this level, and one on either side on the first balcony level above, came a stream of beings shouting, charging toward Luke and his party. They were humans and humanoids, male and female, their clothes largely filthy and in tatters, carrying primitive spears and knives and crude swords in their hands. In moments, at least a score were charging Luke's position, and more were pouring out of the doorways. Luke breathed a sigh of relief. "Time to make contact," he said. He reached up for his helmet. "Run," Bindi said. "What?" "Run!" Bindi suited actions to words by turning back the way they'd come and racing away from the oncoming mob. Luke looked at Mara, both shrugged, then turned to follow Bindi, the rest close after them. They charged out through the broad archway that had heralded the opening into the shopping gallery, quickly outdistancing their pursuers. They took a right at the next broad cross corridor, charged a considerable distance along it, and then Bindi angled into a doorway that led to an emergency stairwell. She led them up the stairs two at a time until they'd climbed 5 flights. Then they could emerge into a much darker, narrower corridor. There they stopped, many of them panting. Kel leaned over to put his hands on his knees as he struggled to breathe. "I'm too old for this." Danny leaned against the wall. Sweat poured down her face, but did not mar her Yuuzhan Vong makeup. "Would you mind telling me why we ran? I thought you wanted to make contact with pockets of survivors. Something about setting up resistance cells?" Bindi offered her an unlovely smile. "Two reasons. First, normal people who want to stay alive don't charge Yuuzhan Vong warriors that way, even if they outnumber them 100 to 1, meaning that they probably had some way to kill those supposed warriors, like retreating before us and leading us to a spot where 50 tons of scrap can drop on our heads." Danny considered that, and her expression relented. "Good point." "Second," Bindi continued, "we don't have any reason to believe that any of the Vong warriors who attacked us on the walkway are still alive. Some are chopped up, some are blown up, some are flat as a roadway accident 300 meters down, and some are all three. So our secret, the fact that we're wandering around in effective Yuuzhan Vong disguises, is probably intact. If we let 100 starving survivors know about it, inevitably one will sell us out, and the Vong will know, too." "So," Luke said, "a detachment of us take off our disguises and go to talk to them as humans." "Well, the rest wait here and breathe," Kel said. "Right." Luke looked over them. "It'll be me, Mara, Face, and Bindi going back. The rest stay here." Instead of offering up a noise of complaint, Tahiri grimaced, a cynically adult expression, and lowered her pack to the passageway floor. Luke shrugged, offered her a smile. "We need at least one Jedi with each group." "So I'm babysitting people 2x, 3x my age. Where's the fun in that?" Kel snorted, then pitched his voice as an adolescent whine. "Aunt Tahiri, tell me a story." Luke, now dressed in the dark garments he affected whenever making a public appearance in the guise of Jedi Master, stared at the woman on the other side of the heating element protruding from the gap in the floor panels. He, his 3 companions, also in dark, inconspicuous civilian dress, and 6 men and women of the Walkway Collective sat cross-legged on the floor, in a loose circle around the heating element, while a pot of greenish soup rested atop the thing and gradually heated to boiling. "How have you survived?" Luke asked. They were in a back room of what had once been a clothing emporium of the Katir Walkway, the shopping gallery where Luke's party had so recently been attacked. The woman he addressed, once plump and blonde, he thought, now leaner from a subsistence diet, hair streaked with dirt, brown eyes hard from sacrifice and suffering, was Tenga Javik, nominal leader of the Walkway Collective. "We've rigged photon collection screens and heat harvesters for power," she said. Her voice was raspy. That and the light scarf wound around her neck, a curious affectation in the warm, moist air of Coruscant's landscape of building interiors, suggested that she had taken an injury to the throat in the not-too-distant past. "One of us worked at a gray weave production plant. Have you ever eaten gray weave, Master Skywalker?" "On occasion." Grayweave was the nickname for a sort of single-cell organism-based food, manufactured for and sold to the poorest of the poor. In texture, it looked like thick gray felt, but didn't taste anywhere near as good. Its chief virtues were that it was very inexpensive and lasted a long time without preservation. "We stole the Greyweave reactors and scattered them all through our territory," Tenga said. "Well hidden. We keep them supplied with power and water. Water we process through our own stills. We hide from the Vong most of the time, set traps for them when we're sure we can take them. We're going to survive, Master Skywalker." "How's the air?" Bindi asked. Tenga looked into the soup, as if unwilling to meet Bindi's eyes. "Getting worse," she said. "We're working on that, trying to put together a series of blowers to bring in air from where it's better." She didn't sound confident. "If that doesn't work, we may have to relocate, go deeper." She met Luke's eyes, her expression suddenly fierce. "When will the fleet come, Master Skywalker? When can we expect relief?" "Not soon," he admitted. "I wish I could tell you differently, but you're going to have to rely on yourselves for some time to come." Several of Tenga's fellows sighed or made noises of discontent, but they didn't direct anger at Luke. His words did not seem to be entirely unexpected. Tenga returned her attention to the soup. "We need the fleet," she rasped, her tone lower. She did not seem to be speaking to Luke. "We need the Jedi." "This is our first mission back," Luke said, projecting confidence with his voice and through the Force. "And more will come. We're not going to let Coruscant remain in enemy hands. You have to decide whether you're going to be alive when the world is liberated, because the weariness and disillusionment you're feeling can kill you as surely as the Yuuzhan Vong." "You've done very well here," Bindi said. "I can show you how to do better." That got Tenga's attention. "Better how?" "Hide better. Ambush and defeat Vong patrols better. Repair and maintain equipment better."
"I'm listening," Tenga said.
"First things first," Mara interrupted. "A little more information. Have any of you seen or felt anything unusual in this region? I mean, unusual in excess of all the changes brought on by the Vong?"
Most of those present shook their heads, but one in the second rank of the circle, a thin, middle-aged man with a dark, suspicious look to his features, said, "Lord Nyax." Some of his companions sighed. One or two offered up little groans. Luke grinned before he could suppress it.
"That's a children's story."
"He's real," Yasot said.
Mara raised an eyebrow.
"I haven't heard this one." "In ancient times," Luke said, "on Corellia, Lord Nyax was what parents threatened their children with if they didn't eat their stew fruit or go to bed on time. If you keep on being a bad boy, Lord Nyax will come for you. He was a monstrous pale ghost who took children away, and no one ever saw them again."
"A typical folk tale," Mara said.
"Yes,"
Luke sobered. "But a while back, stories of Lord Nyax got a lot more common. Because during the Jedi purges, there was someone who came for children in the night. Someone who came for Force-sensitive children."
Mara's reply was a whisper, "Darth Vader."
"That's right.
I think that some of Darth Vader's covert missions to round up Force-sensitive children became merged with the Lord Nyax legend and spread from Corellia all over the galaxy during the early Imperial years."
"Yasot here is one of our far scouts," Tenga said. "He travels out beyond our territories, exploring and scavenging."
"And he sees things," another said. That man tapped his temple with one hand while jerking a thumb at Yasot with the other, suggesting that Yasot was not completely functional in a mental sense.
"I do see things," Yasot said, "but they're there."
"Tell me what you see," Luke said.
"I saw Lord Nyax for the first time about a month after Coruscant fell."
Yasot's voice lowered in tone and volume. "This was over toward the old heart of the government district, where things are crazy now. I was on one side of the main chamber of a textile factory, hiding from a Vong hunting party. They were on the other side. I was already scared, but I got a lot more scared and didn't know why. Then the screaming started. Where the warriors were, I could see someone moving, a big man, ghostly white. There was a roar and flashes of red all around it.
but no sound of blasters. I got away. Hours later, I came back. I found the Vong warriors dead, chopped to pieces, burned in places, some of them eaten on. The second time was 4 days ago or so. From a pocket, he pulled a functional chrono and checked local time. 4 days. I felt that fear again while I was prowling through rooftops well below the skyline. It got worse and worse, and I knew I was being stalked. I knew I was going to end up like those Vong warriors. "How did you get away?" Mara asked. Yasot shook his head, not meeting her gaze. "I just got away." "That's not good enough," Tenga said. "No one just gets away. You get away by getting captured and selling us out?" "No." Yasot's voice became emphatic. He returned his attention to Mara. "There's a man, calls himself Skiffer, part of a group, not part of the Walkway Collective. They prey on us. They've killed a couple of our scouts, found and stole one of our Greyweave reactors. Greyweave's not enough for them. I'm sure some of them are cannibals. I know where their territory is. I led Lord Nyx through the heart of their territory, and when I heard Skiffer give his people a call to action, I made a break for it. I heard them screaming." He met Tenga's eyes. "I didn't sell us out, Tenga. I sold Skiffer out." Tenga clapped him on the shoulder. "Good work." Another man said, "You were being stalked by Vong, Yasot. There is no Lord Nyx, just your imagination." Yasot glared, but didn't respond. "Where have you run into Lord Nyx?" Luke asked. Yasot pointed northwest, precisely in the direction where Luke and the other Force-sensitives had felt the twinge. "That way. Near the old government center. It's thick with Vong compared to here, but full of interesting salvage." "We need to look at that," Luke said. He addressed Yasot. "Care to come with us, to guide us?" Tenga shook her head. "Not unless you leave us this one," she indicated Bindi, "in trade." But Yasot shook his head. "Prowl around with a big noisy party when there are Vong hunters about? No. Kill me now instead. It'd be less painful." Luke shrugged. "We'll be back then." Yasot offered him a look of sympathy. "No, you won't." Borlias. Gina stood up, her bedsheet whirling away from her, and lurched to her closet without knowing why. The sun, Puria, was just now climbing above the horizon, so she had been in bed for perhaps 3 hours. The roaring in her ears resolved itself into an alarm. "Yuuzhan Vong, we're coming." She heard the roar of thrusters from whichever squadrons were at the ready. It would be Black Moon at this hour. Jag was waiting for her in the hallway, the special secured hall of the biotics building, reserved for the pilots of Twin Sun Squadron. Other doors were sliding open. Piggy Sabinring, struggling to fasten the seal of his pilot suit over his expansive Gamorrean stomach, emerged. "What's our objective?" Jaina asked. Jag held out a datapad for her to look at, but her eyes wouldn't focus on it. She irritably waved it away. "It looks like an assault on this location," Jag synopsized. "Flying vehicles only. No sign of ground troops. Luzonkia's squadrons have some of the enemy forces engaged in orbit. More will be here in moments." There was an explosion not far away as incoming fire hit the shields that protected the biotics facility. All the transparent steel viewports on the west face of the building rattled. "Correction," Jag said. "They'll be here now." "Let's move." Jaina led her half-dressed, half-awake squadron to their turbolift. Corrin Horn, pilot and Jedi Knight, flying as Rogue Nine, activated his repulsors and smoothly lifted off the ferrocrete of Rogue Squadron's new docking bay, up through a gap where, moments before, the ceiling had been. The building's roof was still cantilevering out of the way. The altitude gave him a better look at the conflict. Yuuzhan Vong coral ships, the equivalent of light cruisers, hovered in the distance both east and west, protected by screens of coral skippers, and launched barrages of plasma at the biotics building and its outbuildings. So far, the base's shields, removed not that long before from faltering new Republic capital ships, were holding up well against the assault. "Come on, Leth."
Pick, pick, pick.
Leth Leav's X-wing rose up beside Corrin's. Leth, a Sulistan female, had been a fighter pilot before being shot down and captured by the Yuuzhan Vong. Placed in an environment bubble and launched through space toward Borlias's atmosphere in a show of Yuuzhan Vong cruelty, she and several of her fellows had been saved by some fancy flying on the part of Twin Sun Squadron. Corrin doubted that, in better times, she would ever have qualified for the famed Rogue Squadron, but here, with attrition high and options few, she'd been welcomed. "Leader to squad, less chatter, please." Colonel Darklighter sounded as businesslike as ever. "Indicate readiness. Leader is ready. 2. 2 ready. 3. As the roll call continued, the third member of Corrin's shield trio, Dakorce Teep, rose into position. "Rogue 7, all green." Corrin grimaced. In Teep's case, green didn't just refer to the condition of his engines. Teep was a teenager who should have been palling around on the playground with Corrin's son Valen, only a few years Teep's junior. Corrin heard Leth announce, 8, 4 lit and ready. Then he said, 9, optimum. He was the last one to call in readiness. Rogue Squadron was reduced to 9 members now, 3 shield trios. Other squadrons were in worse condition, some of them reduced in numbers so fast that they had to be decommissioned or temporarily merged with other depleted units until reinforcements could swell them out into discrete squads again. "We're on the cruiser to the east," Gavin announced. "Senior members have proton torps. Everyone else, you'll have to make do with lasers. Sorry. Break by shield trios, now." He suited action to words, and the 3 members of one flight lofted, rising above the protection of the facility's vertical shields, staying only a few dozen meters beneath the horizontal shield overhead. Corrin waited a beat while 2 flight followed, then he led Leth and Teep up. To her credit, Leth kept tucked in professionally close, but Teep lagged, offering his shield mates no protection from his shields, receiving no protection from theirs. "Close it up, 7, Corrin said. "Sorry, 9, coming." As Corrin and Leth cleared the building's shields and dropped toward the jungle on the far side, a plasma barrage from the cruiser analog they were supposed to destroy arced toward them. If it had been slightly better aimed, it might have slid in between the top of the vertical shields and bottom of the horizontal. As it was, it angled in toward Teep, directly over Corrin's head. 7, he shouted. "Break to port." Corrin chose port over starboard, only because it took half the time to say, giving Teep one more fraction of a second to comprehend and react. Teep did veer to port, as much on repulsor lifts as thrusters, and the main ball of plasma flashed harmlessly past him. Then it hit the building's vertical shields and exploded. The concussion hammered Teep, Corrin, and Leth. His cockpit swathed in flame, Corrin watched his artificial horizon gauge spin. Relying on instinct more than his gauges, he leveled off and hit his thrusters. A moment later, the fire peeled away from his cockpit, and he could see again. Teep and Leth were both rolling as they fell, out of control, toward the jungle below. Leth came out of her roll, leveling off not far above the treetops, and Corrin heard her over the comboard, her voice raised in a wordless shout of both fear and exultation. Teep didn't come out of his roll. He punched through the treetops, and a moment later a fireball roiled up through the hole he'd made. Corrin swore. This war was gobbling up children like a starved wampa. "Come on, 8, form up." In his transport, far below the Luzonkia conflict and as far above the war waging around the biotics building, Harar stared into the viewing lens mounted in the transport's belly. "Is this operation yours or Chulkong Law's?" he asked. Charot Kral knelt beside him at the edge of the lens. "It is the Great Master's, but it is merely a probe, a way to test strength and evaluate the enemy's strengths, to deny him the opportunity to rest. I have attached my mission to this operation." "When do your units enter the battle?"
"Soon,"
when the enemy is stretched thinnest.
Twin Sun's squadron roared westward toward the Yuuzhan Vong cruiser analog there. It and its protective squadrons were already being harassed by Black Moon Squadron and a pair of Thai squadrons off Luzonkia.
"Piggy, analysis," Jaina called.
The mechanical voice of her Gamorrean pilot boomed from the comm unit. Jaina winced and slid the volume control lower.
"They're not concentrating on the biotics building this time," Piggy said. "Probably to avoid a disaster like the last assault. They've learned their lesson from orbital bombardment. And yet they're not systematically taking General Antilles' defensive structure to pieces. They should be concentrating their efforts on removing Luzonkia from the battlefield so they can then move against the facility with minimal opposition. They are not."
Jaina didn't have to ask what that meant. The Yuuzhan Vong didn't intend to overrun the facility this time. They had some other goal, such as staging another attempt to capture Jaina. To the Yuuzhan Vong, twins were sacred, and Jaina, as the twin of Jason, held special fascination for them.
"Keep your eyes open for particular attention on us," Jaina said.
"Yes, Great One."
"Twin sons, don't fire torps unless you have a clear shot you know the voids can't stop," she added. "We've all got a full load, but other squads don't. So don't waste a shot unless you're just anxious to cause hard feelings. Tilath, are you ready with your payload?"
"Yes, Great One."
Tilath Kir, flying Twin Suns 11, sounded distinctly unhappy. On the underside of her X-wing was attached something that looked like a missile, the newest experimental weapon in the Twin Suns' arsenal, but it was longer than the X-wing's cockpit and heavy enough to turn her starfighter into something as maneuverable as a flying boulder.
"Don't worry, Tilath. No one has to do the dishes every time."
Jaina hit her thrusters and accelerated toward the enemy.
"Let's do this thing."
Charat, Krall, and Harar watched as the battle developed. The Yuuzhan Vong capital ships were being used as mobile artillery, keeping up a steady bombardment on the biotics building and the buildings around it to test and potentially overwhelm the infidels' protective energy shields. Their coral skipper squadrons were charged with protection of the capital ships and elimination of enemy starfighters. It was a simple enough situation, and Harar grasped the details readily as Charat Krall explained them.
"Where are the Star Lancer vehicles kept, the pipe fighters?" Harar asked.
He referred to the craft that had, not long before, set up a complicated energy matrix in space in the Pyria system, then fired a laser attack, one that had been somehow accelerated through hyperspace and had actually struck the Yuuzhan Vong worldship in orbit around Coruscant. Charat Krall indicated a square flat building near the biotics building.
"This is where their elites keep their vehicles. Jaina Solo's squadron is housed there. It is not a target of today's exercise, since most of the vehicles housed there are now coming against our forces."
"And where are they growing their lambent crystal?"
The recent spying efforts involving a controlled human male had indicated that the Star Lancer project required the implementation of a gigantic crystal, one grown from Yuuzhan Vong techniques and material, to increase the long-distance laser enough for it to do real harm to distant targets. Charat Krall pointed to the biotics building.
"There. Our agent was unable to search every portion of that structure, but eliminated many. Before he was lost, he communicated to us that he thought the deepest levels of the building, which are among those shut off from the common soldier, were the most likely location for the crystal growing."
He had a hard time saying the next word, so hateful was it in this context.
"Machines. Our next agent will find it and arrange for its destruction if our bombardments do not destroy this facility first."
"Excellent. Now let us discuss the capture of Jaina Solo."
Jaina let off her trigger as the coral skipper in front of her detonated. Its pieces rained down on the jungle below. A quick check of her sensor board revealed that her wingmates, Jagged Fell and Kip Duron, were not far away and were inbound toward her. Ahead was the Yuuzhan Vong cruiser, hundreds of meters of Yorick coral and organic weaponry.
"Let's give its big guns something to think about," Jaina said.
She switched her lasers over to quad fire and began pouring coherent light blasts at the points where the cruiser's giant plasma cannon sprouted from its hull.
"What's your status, Tilath?"
"Lined up on final approach. I'm 15 seconds from optimum firing range."
14.
"Fire when ready. Don't wait for my command."
10.
Jag and Kip joined their laser fire with Jaina's. The voids protecting the cruiser analog had no difficulty moving into position and swallowing the destructive energy from their weapons.
1. Firing.
The missile dropped from the belly of Tilath's X-wing. It fell a dozen meters, then its rear ignited, driving it forward at missile speeds. Jaina clicked her comm board over to operational frequency.
"Execute low bounce. Repeat, low bounce."
In the vicinity of the target cruiser analog, New Republic starfighters began gaining altitude. They didn't flee. They just rose until they were above the cruiser analog's altitude. They continued fighting on their way up, continued fighting at their new altitude. At the same instant, Jaina, Kip, and Piggy armed and fired proton torpedoes, one each. Half a kilometer short of the cruiser analog, Tilath's missile did what it was supposed to. It did not shatter and fly in all directions. It was too sturdily built for that. Most of the missile was an extremely durable metal tube, open at one end. The rear closed portion was packed with a plasma-based explosive charge. The forward two-thirds, sealed only by the fragile nose of the missile, was packed with metal ball bearings the size of human heads. The plasma charge detonated, superheating the ball bearings and firing them toward the target. They shot out, a spreading display of superheated projectiles. Not one of the ball bearings would do significant harm to the target when they hit. The best-placed shots that actually hit the Yorick coral hull would punch through and lodge within, while the rest would bounce harmlessly away. No, the danger they represented was not from hitting. Each ball, heated by the plasma charge, was now identical in specific gravity and temperature to the proton torpedoes catching up to them from behind. The cruiser analog's Dovin Basil sensed the incoming horde of missiles. They did not panic. Fear was not part of their nature. But they knew they could not project their voids into the path of even a fraction of the incoming missiles. Instead, each prioritized projecting its voids over the most vulnerable portions of the vessel's flank, protecting the command crew compartment, weapons emplacements, and itself. Charnot Kral and Harrer watched as the twin suns launched four missiles, one the largest, ahead of the others. The largest one detonated short of its target, showering the Matalok with red-hot debris, but the others flashed straight in to hit 1, 2, 3, against the Matalok side. The infidel weapons flashed impossibly bright, creating clouds of explosive force and debris that had once been the side and internal organs of the Matalok. The vessel heeled over, mortally wounded, and began to turn away from the engagement. Plasma poured from its injury. It gained altitude for a moment, then settled into a straight-line course, and now its Dovin Basils concentrated their void protection only over the main weapons emplacements. Charlotte Kral knew what that meant. The Matalok would not make it back to space, so its commander was ordering the weapons to build up tremendous charges of plasma energy, charges that would destroy the vessel from within. Charlotte Kral sagged as energy and pride left him for a moment. He slammed his fist into the floor next to the viewing lens.
"How did she do it?" he asked.
"How did she persuade the Dovin Basils to let their missiles through?"
"I do not know."
Charlotte Kral met the priest's gaze.
"It is not my place to ask this. You may choose to order me to my death for asking, but I must know. You are a priest of Yun Harla. Surely the truth is in your mind. Is Jaina Solo an avatar of the goddess? Is she the goddess?" Of course not. She is an infidel who mocks our goddess.
But Harar knew that he was no longer able to project confidence when he said such words. He no longer knew whether he was telling the truth. Charat Kroll, no new satisfaction or peace on his features, turned to a villip that lay on the floor next to him. He spoke into the Yuuzhan Vong warrior features it revealed.
"Are you in position?"
"No, Commander. It is early yet."
"Begin your run anyway. We cannot wait for the best moment."
"Understood, Commander."
Corran Horn saw the flight of three coral skippers peel off from the main north side engagement and loop around toward the west side of the biotics building.
"Come on, Eight, let's deal with these strays."
He banked, a tight maneuver to put him in the path of the trio. Leth followed suit, her maneuver not quite as tight as the more experienced pilot's. They were able to get in position well before the coral skippers lined up for an approach. The skips turned again quite a distance out, beyond the kill zone and over the jungle. Now they were aimed in straight at the biotics building. They dropped nearly to the deck and accelerated to something like their full speed, not maneuvering even as Corran and Leth opened fire.
"It's a suicide run," Leth said.
"I think you're right."
Corran looked around. If these three skips were able to hit the shields defending the biotics building, if they were able to crash through them and bring those shields down, there would be a moment when the building was undefended against enemy attacks. But no other Yuuzhan Vong ship stood ready to make use of this momentary advantage. It didn't make sense.
Corran drifted to starboard, spraying fire against the skip on that side and in the center.
Leth drifted to port and followed suit. Their combined fire was too much for the center skip. Some of Corran's laser fire got past its voids, and nearly all of Leth's did. That coral skipper nosedived, smashing into the ground at the outer range of the kill zone. It did not explode. Skips, not loaded with fuel, did not always detonate. It just came to pieces, scattering chunks of itself. That gave each pilot one enemy to concentrate on. Corran kept the pressure on, spraying the oncoming skip with laser fire as if it were water from a hose, and saw his attacks chewing away at the forward portions of the craft. He could see in his peripheral vision that Leth was having less luck with the other oncoming skip, but he couldn't deal with that, not with his target spraying plasma at him. Corran maneuvered his X-wing directly into the path of the oncoming skip. If its pilot's objective really was the shields, it would have to maneuver around him. If not, well, he'd be taking that opponent out of the battle the hard way. But it maneuvered, bouncing down to fly under him, and his lasers punched through the skip's canopy. The vehicle veered, losing control. Then it exploded, hurling pieces in all directions. Corran veered, was caught in the explosion for a moment, emerged out the other side with diagnostics complaining of no damage worse than a superheated external temperature sensor. He came around and saw that Leth was also looping. Her target had gotten past her and was now headed in toward the shields. The skip hit, and for an instant Corran could see the energy of the impact as it made the shield visible, made it ripple like a pond surface suddenly struck by a plummeting land speeder. The coral skipper went to pieces, shredded by the impact. Chunks of it sprayed out across the kill zone directly in front of the biotics building. One of the larger chunks hit a dirt hauler that had been pressed into service as a ground personnel carrier. That vehicle exploded, and flames splashed across surrounding buildings and vehicles. Some chunks of the coral skipper bounced to within meters of the front of the biotics building.
"I'm sorry."
Leth's voice was pained, full of recognition of her failure.
"Too full."
Corran snorted, remembering the melodrama that tended to play in new pilots' minds.
"Not much harm done," he said. "Don't worry about it. Come on, back to work."
Corran and Leth wheeled off together to rejoin the squadron. Damage control crews spilled out of the biotics building and its associated docking bays, spraying firefighting foams on the burning portions of destroyed coral skippers. A crew chief, a black-haired Corellian woman whose build suggested that there might be a rancor or two in her ancestry, waved frantically at the other members of her unit.
"I have a man down here. Bring medics."
She bent and shoved a large piece of coral skipper shell off the victim,
a tall human in a drab mechanic's jumpsuit. Remarkably, he seemed unburned, and as the woman wrestled the shell from him, his eyes opened. Though bland-featured, he had an expressive, intent stare, and looked first at his rescuer and then at his surroundings without confusion. "No medic," he said. "I am not hurt." She extended a hand down and helped haul him to his feet. "You may be hurt worse than you know." "No, I am not hurt." He looked around. "Put me to work." She jerked a thumb toward the largest remaining portion of the coral skipper, where more members of her unit were working. "Join them. Look for survivors like yourself. And if you feel strange, if you feel anything wrong, go talk to the medics." Yes. Without offering a thank you, the tall man headed in the direction the crew chief had indicated. She motioned after him, a gesture suggesting irritation. "He's in shock. They'll wrestle him down when it gets obvious." But as she continued her search through pieces of skip debris, she caught sight of the man on several occasions as he helped her crew, carrying the injured to aid stations, shoving debris aside to look for other survivors. With half its capital ship resources gone, the Yuuzhan Vong attack was done. The remaining cruiser Analog and two units of coral skippers took to the skies, harassed by New Republic starfighters, until General Antilles called off the pursuit. "How's the leg, Tark?" Han asked. The boy on the hospital ward bed, brown-haired, blue-eyed, and impossibly energetic, pulled aside the sheet to show his right leg. Much of his calf was covered by a transparent Bacta bandage. The bandage was pink from the healing material contained within it, but still clear enough to show the angry lines of a crescent-shaped burn on the skin beneath. "Not bad," the boy said. "I can't run very fast, but I can walk. They just don't want me to." Han tried to say something, to offer some smart remark at the expense of the medical staff, but it wouldn't come. He'd been through this scene many times, offering put-on-a-brave-face advice to his own son, Anakin. And the simple fact that this boy wasn't Anakin, despite his near-identical resemblance to him, was like a vibroblade being shoved centimeter by centimeter into his chest. Leia seemed to sense Han's hesitation. "Well, you listen to them," she said. Her own voice seemed just a trifle hoarse, too. "If we get back from our mission and hear that you've been pushing yourself too hard, we're going to be angry." "What if I bribed them not to tell you?" Han swallowed against the lump in his throat and managed to force his voice into something like its normal register. "Bribe them with what? This isn't exactly a money-based economy, kid." "I could put on a show and charge admission, but instead of taking money, I could make everybody who came promise not to tell you that I'd been running around." Leia gave him a cool politician smile. "You forget about our spies. They're everywhere, you know." "What if I started my own spy network and figured out which ones your spies were and kept them from coming to my show?" Leia reached out to ruffle the boy's hair. "We have to go, but we'll stop in before we leave Borlias." "I could go with you. I can be a diplomat." "Sorry, kid," Han said. "I figure you'll be too busy practicing for your show." "I don't need to practice. I'll just make it all up as I go along." Han and Leia shared a look, a glance of private amusement and long experience. "Well," Leia said, "there's some merit in that approach, too. Goodbye for now." "Later, kid." As they left the ward, Leia said, "He's going to be bored while we're gone." "We could leave Goldenrod to babysit him, tell him stories." "It's better that he be bored than horribly bored, Han."
"True."
C-3PO stood near the Millennium Falcon's parking space on the kill zone and stared up at the topside hull of the light freighter. Han Solo was up there, as he often was between flights of the ancient vehicle. He wore goggles as he performed arcane welding tasks on the hull. C-3PO did not watch Han. Instead, his attention was on the sparks from the torch. A stream of them leaped from the hull and drifted downward, extinguishing themselves before they ever quite reached the char that covered the ground. C-3PO watched one begin its flight, reached the top of its arc, and turned downward. He became aware that another droid had wandered into his field of vision. This droid was angular, armored, warlike of aspect, carrying one of the largest and newest blaster rifles available to New Republic warriors. But he was not approaching in a posture of menace. "Greetings," C-3PO said. "I am C-3PO."
"YVH-11A," the other replied. "Assigned as soldier and bodyguard to Lando Calrissian, currently on miscellaneous duty, investigating anomalies."
"You are an anomaly. What is a protocol droid doing, monitoring the repair efforts of Han Solo and his crew?"
"Oh, never. I am not monitoring repairs. I am not even paying attention to the repairs. In an effort to improve my language skills, I am struggling to determine the best word to describe the descent and extinguishment of the sparks from the repair process."
"This should be no problem for a protocol droid."
"It should not be, but it is, because the word that seems most apt is not the one that is most logical."
"What word is most apt?"
"Sad."
11A's cams clicked over to watch the sparks for a fraction of a second, then returned to C-3PO.
"You are correct. That word is not appropriate."
"It is most appropriate. Each spark seems somehow symbolic, of life, glowing brightly as it traverses a course, then disappearing. Does it leave anything behind?"
"If it strikes a flammable substance, it will leave something behind."
"Is it anomalous for me to say that you are an insensitive block of armor and aggression-based programming?"
Curiously, 11A did not respond immediately, but clicked his cams over toward the sparks for another fraction of a second. Finally, he said,
"Do you suppose, in the final nanoseconds, a spark feels fear, knowing that its duration is at an end?"
"I doubt it. I most sincerely doubt it. A spark is incapable of feeling fear, or indeed even of considering its own mortality."
"That is also said of droids. But in some cases it is not true."
Now it was C-3PO's turn to hesitate.
"If I may say, that is a most insightful statement coming from a combat droid."
"I face extinguishment regularly. This has given me many opportunities for reflection. I have recently been unable to ignore this consideration. I suspect these calculations have even begun to affect my work."
"I, too, have had to face these thoughts recently. Most unsettling. And my counterpart, R2-D2, is no help at all, philosophically. Everything terminates, he tells me. Face it bravely." "I suppose that's an adequate philosophy for an astromech, but I find it wholly inadequate. I have wondered if I were the only droid in existence capable of worrying as I do. It's most refreshing to discover that I am not alone."
YVH-11A's cams clicked back toward C-3PO's face.
"If you come to any conclusions, even unverifiable ones, will you communicate them to me?"
"I should be delighted. Likewise, if you have any insights, please transmit them to me. Perhaps we can talk again."
"Yes."
YVH-11A continued on his rounds. The spark, whose progress C-3PO had begun tracking just before he'd noticed the combat droid, finally disappeared a meter above the ground, a full 2 seconds after it had leaped from the Falcon's hull.